Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Jim and Austin. It's been a while since we've done one of these, but we're hoping to get a good start here for the new year. Over the Christmas holiday, something interesting happened. We had the panty bomber that tried to blow up a Northwestern flight. But our concern isn't the security and like that. You know, we sometimes cover, you know, airport security and like that in Strategy Page. But what, you know, our focus is where it's coming from, what's happening, how do we take it out at its source. And so today I thought maybe we could talk about Yemen a little bit. And Austin, if you could give us like a 5-minute history lesson on it, and then we'll get into what's happening there today.
Well, could I ask you a question, Dan? Why do you want to call him the panty bomber instead of the Christmas terrorist, huh?
I don't know. Framing it
as the Christmas terrorist actually puts it into a little bit of the shape that Al-Qaeda wanted, the message wanted to send. I think the panty bomber is funny, and I think laughing at Al-Qaeda, it's, you know, they have no sense of humor. That's good. That's a good tack to take. But nevertheless, it was supposed to come off on Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. They came darn close.
All right.
We should point out that this is the second operation this particular team, you know, that put this bomb together has run. Actually, possibly the third. There was another one last 2 months ago in Nigeria that may or may not have been from this gang. Anyway, the previous one last year was they took that type of explosive, PETN. And they took a condom or something and stuck it up a guy's butt and detonated it, trying to kill a senior Saudi official.
Ah, yes.
Unfortunately, it was so far up it muffled the explosion and it just got messy. But the second time around, I'm sure they're not releasing this information, but, you know, whatever the plan was, it didn't quite come to fruition. But the first one did. The first one exploded, so apparently they were confident that, you know, it works when it's stuck up your ass, so, you know, it should work when it's hanging from your underwear.
Right, and
who knows what goes on.
That's a good thing to point out. I don't think I've heard anybody point that out. And we do have pictures.
People don't like to touch that sort of stuff.
Right. We do have pictures up on the site of the aftermath of that, which is a bit ugly. So
for the strong of stomach. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Let me give you a quick 30-second at Yemen. Yemen, at once upon a time, was the wealthy corner of the Arabian Peninsula for a lot of reasons. It had water. It had more population, and because it had greater agricultural resources because of the water. It's got a long history. That's the area that the Queen of Sheba was allegedly from. Yemen divides into many parts, but nominally into two. For a long time, there was a North and South Yemen. South Yemen really built around the port city of Aden, Aden is quite a cosmopolitan place. There was a huge British base there for years. Northern Yemen, that's where Sana'a is, the capital, won their little civil war that they had. But northern Yemen also was a site of a ongoing war in its outback, both with the Yemeni government, and then the Egyptians invaded Yemen under Nasser. The Egyptians used poison gas, likely mustard or a mustard derivative based on the studies, on many of these Yemeni tribesmen that live in the rough territory that really straddles the border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Has there been terrorist activity in Yemen? Absolutely. There was a action in 1992 that may or may not be attributable to Al-Qaeda or an Al-Qaeda predecessor. Recall a coal bombing in October of 2000. action on the Arabian Peninsula itself. You can go onto the West Point counterterror site, the so-called Harmony Project, and look up at the letter to Abu Abdullah, which is another name for Osama bin Laden, and it's dated in June of 2000, and it talks about the oil spot strategy against Saudi Arabia and really outlines a potential and actual al-Qaeda operations on the Arabian Peninsula. Of course, they look at Yemen as a place that they could use as a base to operate against Saudi Arabia. So I think that's a relevant sketch there. Your long-term troubles, I do notice that yesterday the BBC quoted President Obama as saying that al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, which is their al-Qaeda's nom de guerre in Yemen, was created because of a response to Guantanamo Bay. I just don't know how you can get away with a comment like that when you look at the Harmony material that I just mentioned and the string of actions that al-Qaeda has had in Yemen over the last 18 years.
Right. Now, Jim, we have had ongoing operations in Yemen, right?
Well, yeah. Yemen, even before the coal was bombed by the suicide boat in 2000. The United States had been offering Yemen, you know, whatever help they would accept to control the Islamic radicalism. Yemen is a crazy quilt of tribes and factions. The big player right now are the northern Shia tribes. Now, this is odd. You think Saudi Arabia, you know, the Arabian Peninsula, they're down on the Red Sea coast. The Shia are, according to Sunni conservatives, and the Sunnis are the ones who run Saudi Arabia and are 80-some percent of the Muslims, they consider the Shia to be heretics. Al-Qaeda, for example, who is allied with these Shia, rebellious Shia tribes, is on the record as basically saying death to the Shia, and they practice what they preach. They were very brutal to the Shia in Iraq, who are, I forget the percentage, but it's 10-something percent. It's a fairly large percentage of the Afghanistan population is Shia, and of course in Iraq they're a majority. Nonetheless, I guess it's the enemy, my enemy is my friend, and Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi tribes in northern Yemen have actually been working together, much to some people's surprise. The tribes are more concerned, actually the tribes are a sect of the Shia, you know, sect, as it were. Their whole thing is more tribal tradition than religion. I mean, they're very proud and very stubborn and, you know, in holding to their Shia beliefs. But at the same time, they are very much more aware of the fact that they are a distinct tribal organization. And until the 1960s, they had, for a long time, centuries, a recognized autonomy in their tribal areas. And over the last 30 years, it's been taken away from them, and they don't like it. They're still trying to get it back. And that's really the root cause of the rebellion. The problem with their autonomy was they considered it a blank check to go raiding and indulging in basically what we consider banditry, and then hide out in their autonomous tribal territory. And this didn't go down well with the neighbors, and eventually it came to a head. And so it's not just religion and ideology that's being fought over up north. It's basically tribal autonomy. Now, Al-Qaeda really exists in Yemen mainly because they have no place else to go. The Yemeni government has always been down on Islamic radicals. However, because of the fact that Yemen is a crazy quilt of dozens of clans and tribes that have to be constantly placated. I mean, everybody's complaining, why is so-and-so getting this and I'm not getting that? Yemen's a poor country. There's not much graft to go around. So, you know, the guy who's running it, who is, by the way, a Shia Muslim from one of the northern tribes. So on top of everything else, he's a traitor to his people. He's been very resourceful, as have some of his key aides, in basically carrying on this balancing act. It's like herding cats. And in doing that, you basically have to look the other way when one or more of these factions is providing shelter and other support to Al-Qaeda. Because some of these clans and factions are very old school Muslim. And they basically agree with Al-Qaeda. They don't openly support Al-Qaeda, but covertly, you know, behind everybody lives in these little, you know, fortresses you see all over the Middle East. Gives you an idea of the public safety situation. Nobody knows what's going on in a lot of those places. In a lot of those places, they're making bombs and stockpiling weapons. Yemen is another place where you're not a man unless you're carrying a weapon, whether it's a, you know, a pistol, a knife, or an AK-47. Government attempts to disarm the people have been a failure. Just running the country is a marginal success. So it's a very unstable area. It could possibly collapse into something like Somalia or Afghanistan, a failed state, as we like to call it. But for right now, they're hanging on. And so the United States has a very, very tricky situation there. For one thing, you don't want to give too much American aid because, you know, opposition politicians are already screaming about we don't want American troops. Now, the United States has never offered to send troops to Yemen. But, you know, talk is going on, oh, the Americans are going to invade us and occupy us, etc. Yeah, the usual, you know, slogans. So we have to tread very carefully. We apparently do provide some special forces, operations type people, a lot of intelligence support, and money. The United States is paying for the police force and various other security forces. Money can go a long way. But basically, you know, it's a very unstable ally in a very uncertain situation. And that's the main reason why a few months ago Saudi Arabia got involved. Saudi Arabia basically sent their armed forces down there and sealed their border, not just with troops but with smart bombs and a lot of firepower. They're, of course, concerned, and indeed they have caught in the last year, since the summer, they've been catching more of these Al-Qaeda guys coming across with suicide bomb vests, you know, basically trying to send suicide bombers into Saudi Arabia to attack senior officials for the most part. They've learned their lesson. They're not blowing up as many civilians anymore. They're going right for the gusto. And so, naturally, the Saudis are very touchy about that. The Yemenis have basically said with some truth that Saudi Arabia is not invading Yemen. There's a lot of bad blood between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. We won't go into that. It gets complicated, but, you know, it goes back a ways. So the Yemeni government has to worry about justifying, you know, invading Saudi Arabian troops and invading American troops. And, of course, there are no American troops or Saudi Arabian troops in Yemen. There might be a few Saudis, you know, wandering across the border when they're patrolling because it's a largely undefined border out in the middle of the desert. But they're just trying to help the Yemenis as much as they can. But, you know, in the final analysis, Yemen might be beyond any help.
Yeah, Austin, the demographics of Yemen are sort of scary, where that right now possibly under 50% of the population is under 18, and they've got a huge unemployment happening with a rapidly growing population. How is that going to affect
things? Here's one of the other things. The Yemenis have been exporting their people for probably would be safe for centuries, but certainly for decades. A lot of Yemeni workers and other at doing very low wage jobs in other places in the Middle East. It's because of the quote unquote excess population, the fact that they've got compared to their neighbor Saudi Arabia, they've got gas and oil deposits, but it's not certainly not on the scale of Saudi Arabia or Iraq. You're speaking there, Dan, to the so-called testosterone problem in many Muslim nations. Young, unemployed males, for the most part, and that has been a large recruiting pool. Maybe the recruiting pool is the way to put it for Al-Qaeda and Islamist extremist groups. Let me take another tack on a couple of things Jim pointed out. Look, there are some interesting analogs between Yemen and Somalia, which is right across the Red Sea and, you know, the, basically from and down the coast on the Horn of Africa from Yemen. Actually, if you look at it, Djibouti is across the Red Sea from them, but you've got the same kind of tribal factions. You've got also splinter political factions, clans within tribes, and it is, as Jim aptly described it, to try to run the place, herding cats, except, you know, these are herding cats with AK-47s and bombs and very, very disparate agendas. I want to point out that we've had special operations personnel in Yemen for quite some time. In 2003, one of our earliest, at least advertised, predator hits against an al-Qaeda bigwig occurred in eastern Yemen, and that is in that quote-unquote undefined border area. It was actually in Yemen, as I understand, where it was taken, but still, how porous and poorly patrolled the border is with Saudi Arabia. The concept was that some of these guys were moving in and out from their Saudi sources or even homes there in Saudi Arabia into the bases in Yemen. So we've been looking at that with predators and intelligence assets for quite some time, certainly since 9/11. And before that, we were concerned, very concerned, about after the coal bombing of security for U.S. personnel, diplomatic and personnel and business people, as well as the military. As I recall, what we had was a long-term refueling deal for the Navy down in Aden. Jim can correct me on that, or maybe elaborate on it. And that was one of the things that they were saying. Well, see here, the bad old United States is moving in on us, even though there was you could look at that as that was actually a good deal for the port, because that's been in the ship replenishment business for, what, 1,500 years, I suppose? That's what the people in Aden do. That was flipped into, here comes the United States Navy. It's just going to take over the port, which hadn't been the case. But our concerns go back, certainly, into the 1990s. You can see the roots of it, and as without repeating it, I want to point out that the documentation is there on the web of al-Qaeda's and Sunni Islamic extremist organizations that are likely al-Qaeda affiliates have been operating there since at least the early 1990s.
Oh, wow.
So what, Jim, how do the U.S. and the Europeans keep this boiling pot under control?
Well, they have kept it under control for a long time with adroit diplomacy and a lot of money. A lot of money wisely spent. They didn't just throw money at the government and let the government senior officials steal it and leave things as messy as they were in the first place. The money, and this is an untold story because these are the sort of things that you can't really issue a press release about. But they have been very clever in the way they dole out the money. They have supported those groups in Yemen that basically what passes for good government groups in the area. Yemen is acutely aware of the fact that it has fallen way behind the rest of the region because they have no oil. One of the reasons for the animosity with the oil Arabs to the north is that those Arabs up north for thousands of years were the hillbillies. They were the Bedouins. They were the starving suckers coming out of the desert looking for handouts. And all of a sudden, in an instant, they are rich beyond belief. And Yemen is basically, Yemen, like the rest of the Muslim world, the Arab world in particular, fell behind, after the Industrial Revolution. And they're all sitting there staring at their past glories and wondering, what the hell hit us? What's wrong? And, of course, it's still popular in the Arab world to say, well, it's not our fault. It's the Crusaders. It's the West. It's everything but us. There are some Yemenis who realize, look, guys, the world has changed. They are somewhat encouraged by the United Arab Emirates, where they just opened the tallest building in the world, you know, and despite the real estate collapse in Dubai and you know, other parts of the UAE, they're still doing quite well. You know, even the Saudis, who basically could have squandered their money even more than they did, have done fairly well. But the trading Arabs, the mercantile Arabs along the coast, which includes the Yemenis, have done extremely well. They're basically trying to turn themselves, as they say it, you know, into another Lebanon, because Lebanon for centuries has been the example of a service, you know, economy. We got nothing else. You know, the Lebanese cut down the cedars, you know, they lost the cedars centuries ago, and there's not much farming, but they basically trade like champions. And the Arabs along the Persian Gulf Coast have been doing the same thing, and the Yemenis say we should be doing that, but at the same time, they have these internal tribes and clans who are basically old school. So, hey, we got the monsoon every year, we got some water, we got some crops, yes, but you've also got modern medicine and sanitation, and you got far more people than the land can support. You know, this huge population boom is sort of a not so useful gift from the West. You know, came in with minimal, what we consider minimal medicine and sanitary practices, which eliminated the thing that had been keeping the population under control for thousands of years, and the population has literally skyrocketed in the last century or two because of that. People don't like to talk about this, but that has been causing a lot of the problems in many parts of the world, and Yemen is one of them. As Austin pointed out, you know, half the population's, you know, teenagers, unemployed teenagers. They got no economy to speak of, and trying to create it is fighting against these old school guys in the interior who really don't even want to send girls to school. They don't even want to send a lot of their boys to school, for that matter. So they have a very difficult situation, which they are desperate to work out of. But as Austin points out, the solution so far has been everybody to get the hell out as long as they could. They had a big setback in that area, and this is an example of how things work in that part of the world. In 1990, when Saddam invaded Kuwait, he was applauded by the Yemenis. They said, "Oh yes, our savior," because you know Saddam had brought in big time into the whole business of it's not our fault; it's all the foreigners, it's all the Christians are screwing us over in some mysterious way or another. And so Saddam, when Saddam came into Kuwait, and he basically told the Yemenis, "Hey, we're going to give you some of this oil, more than the Saudis are." The Yemenis, over a million of whom were working in Saudi Arabia at the time, said, "Hey, yeah, we're all for that." Saudis turned around and threw them all back, sent them all back to Yemen. So the Yemeni economy proceeded to collapse.
I'm sorry, one of the things I would intended to bring up. A couple of times they've had this message there, the Yemeni diaspora has been turned back on them because of politics, and that's probably the biggest example right there that Jim brought up. So,
yeah, in fact, you mentioned diaspora. Like in New York City, for example, at least where I live, almost all of the most of the newsstands and these corner stores and what have you are run by Yemenis. They're doing quite well. They keep the places open 24 hours a day, a lot of them, and they've got plenty of business. You know, well, when you come from a poor country, you know how to work. And that expatriate community, as industrious as it is, those remittances, I don't know what the latest number is, it's probably over $1 billion a year, is keeping the economy alive. It's keeping the Somali economy alive. Some say it's keeping the Mexican economy alive because it's like $9 or $10 billion a year goes back from expatriates. That's a huge factor in many poor countries, and Yemen is one of them. But what they're also sending back are educated Yemenis. A lot of Yemenis, not a lot, but a significant number of these expatriate Yemenis go back with a college education or just a high school education and tell their cousins, say, "Hey, look, guys, there's a bigger world out there, and there's other ways to do things." Competing with the guys with the guns and the bombs.
I want to pick up on something other Jim said. That's a good competing with the guys with the guns and the bombs. This is something that I think I know gets lost, at least in the superficial coverage of the mainstream media about of the traditions of a number of Arab countries. Jim was talking about the United Arab Emirates. That was the Trucial Coast. It was also called the Pirate Coast. Those guys were in business as either smugglers, pirates, or tradesmen, and conducting traders conducting international trading throughout from India all the way to the Horn of Africa and up the Red Sea. The same tradition exists again with the seacoast, the Yemenis, and this is a way to make money. You're a wheeler dealer. The mindset with that, though, is you got to get along with your customers, and that runs anathema to the, and I'm talking about in a large scale sense here, anathema to the Al Qaeda type isolationists. That's why when you do hear the theme crop up every once in a while, there's no hope. That's not true. UAE, and as Jim pointed out, that trading tradition, that's a lot of hope for a modernized, taking those traditions and working on them to modernize these countries. Al-Qaeda's against it, though. They don't want that.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
So
and Al-Qaeda runs up against, and that's why Al-Qaeda failed in Arabia. Even before they rose up and started, setting off bombs in Saudi Arabia after we went into Iraq, they couldn't really get any traction. And we forget that the Saudi Arabians basically just signed a piece of paper and expelled Al-Qaeda in the 1990s. There was no fighting in the streets. They just said, you violated the understanding, and you're out of here. There was another understanding which said, all right, any you guys who keep quiet can stay, because the only ones who were expelled were the ones who were mouthing off about, rebellion and killing, Kafirs and, non-Muslims in general. But when they started setting off bombs, the reason why you had this press release about Al-Qaeda in Arabia being reestablished in Yemen was because they were chased out of Saudi Arabia. The bombing lasted for about a year and a half, 2 years, and then the cops had chased them all down. The reason the cops had chased them all down was because most Saudis, although they are still very conservative Muslims, they don't like bombs going off in their own neighborhood. That changes your attitude towards terrorism very quickly, when the bombs are going off down the street. And they started turning these kids in. And pretty soon, they had a most wanted list that had 26 on it, and pretty soon most of them were rounded up or dead, and there was no more terrorism in Saudi Arabia. They went to the closest place where they could survive, and that was Yemen, and they're barely surviving there.
They had infrastructure there. They had bases there, Jim, but, the big target was Saudi Arabia, and again, that Harmony document I pointed out will show you that, but they were going to have these oil spots throughout the Arabian Peninsula, and that would include Yemen, and that spread their influence and ultimately knock off the Sauds, which was one of their... Hey, read the document, folks. You can go find it. It's still on there. I looked at it just last week. So.
Yeah, but for example, one of the last big attacks they made in Yemen was against the American embassy, where they basically slaughtered Yemenis lining up to try to get visas. Now, that went over real big, with most Yemenis. They simply haven't been able to get at the politically correct targets. And it's just like in Saudi Arabia. They tried shooting their way into compounds, occupied by foreigners, and they mainly just killed a lot of, working stiffs who were Saudi security guards, at the gate. And they could never get around. Then they said, well, let's attack the oil facilities. Well, that was real popular in Saudi Arabia. Even the slow learners know that oil is what their fairly comfortable lifestyle depends on. So these guys, have all the wrong ideas and all the wrong tactics. But because of the screwed up, economic and social situation in the Arab world, there's an endless supply of them. Because these societies cannot supply, jobs for their young people. And when you have a lot of young people out of work, a certain percentage of them are going to say, well, hey, if I can't have a job, let's have some fun.
Boom. Dan, before we end this, I have a question for Jim.
Okay.
Right? Jim, what you just described occurred, and as I believe some of those attacks in Saudi Arabia occurred in May 2003, but then there was a slew of them in the spring of 2004 when the Saudis really acted on them. And you characterized that as a screw-up by Al-Qaeda, which it is. How come How come?
Well, because they couldn't.
How
because
come?
For the same reason that Hamas cannot focus its terrorism activities is you have all this factionalism. You know, we tend to think of Al-Qaeda, you know, as some sort of monolith, but of course, as we know here, it isn't. It's a coalition, it's an idea, it's a concept, it's a franchise. Everybody is allowed to have, once you start, you know, forming terrorist groups, everybody wants to be the boss. And of course, that leads to factionalism, and of course nobody wants to take orders. And of course that's exactly what happened in Saudi Arabia. Everybody until 2003 realized that unless you wanted to be driven into exile, you had to keep your head down and your mouth shut. And so everybody could have their guns, they made plans, they drank endless cups of coffee, but they didn't do anything except send money to Afghanistan. And of course, the real hard cases would simply buy a plane ticket, go to Pakistan and get themselves killed, you know, for the cause. But that wasn't universally, you know, popular. But after 2000, after we invaded Iraq in 2003, a lot of those factions said, oh, no, I can't stand this. I mean, this goes against everything I stand for. I have to make a stand. I have to start killing my fellow Saudis. And that's when it all fell apart. And that happens all too often. I mean, Hamas has the problem. Any Islamic radical organization has that discipline problem, and I don't think they're ever going to solve it.
So, in other words, the invasion of Iraq set a strategic situation where these guys came out, much to their own.
Yeah, I think in the history books, you know,
that invasion
of Iraq is going to be seen as a bold stroke that basically broke the back of Al-Qaeda, because it basically took the war to their territory and forced them to stand and fight. That is a classic military maneuver.
That's something what that, I tell you, that view has been on strategy page from
the beginning.
9/11. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you can blame Jim Gunn and get an
military history.
Okay.
But it's military history 101. You read any military history, any amount of military history, and you see that many times in the past, there were situations where you couldn't get the enemy to fight, especially irregulars, whether it be Alexander the Great fighting the Afghan tribes, you know, 2,500 years ago, or the British, you know, trying to suppress the Somali tribes 100 years ago. You had to find some way to get them to come out and fight so you could destroy them. And Al-Qaeda was basically going to not get brought out, and it was the invasion of Iraq that did it. And, you know, a historian looks at that and says, brilliant. Everybody else looks at that and says, you know, whatever's on their mind.
Yeah. I know I did a radio show a few years back, and I brought that point up, and the leftists that got on the phone afterwards were going nuts about it, saying, see...
Well, they couldn't understand it.
Right.
They literally couldn't comprehend it. I've run into that. And I say, wait, let's just talk as historians for a second. And they'd slow down a little bit, and they'd take them through, you know, the Mickey's hand is in your gall, and yada, yada, yada. And I'd get a few of them to understand, but a lot of them just went against everything. They were taking it on faith. No, it's not possible. I cannot, my faith cannot handle that. So you don't argue religion. And
right.
Why don't we put this up in 2 weeks, guys?
Yeah,
it's
time to wind it up. And
I'm at fault that I had to ask him, and he knocked it out of the park.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Especially since he just wrote an article yesterday.
I know he did. I read it.
So all right. We'll talk about we'll continue our discussion next time. We'll see you, gentlemen.
All right.
Bye, guys.
Till then. Bye-bye.